Hello, hello.
Hello and welcome back to my channel. Hi, how are you?
To your channel. This is a podcast, hey.
I'm very sad that you did not get my reference.
No, I get it.
What's the reference?
It's just a kind of a YouTube thing, no?
No. I was imitating Jeffree Star.
Oh. Hi,
welcome back to my channel. Hi, how
that's
are
why
you?
I don't know it. I don't watch Jeffree Star. Honestly, YouTube pop. I don't watch popular YouTubers. I watch obscure YouTubers because all of the popular ones are kind of dumb sometimes.
Jeffree Star. I don't know.
I'm not excluding Jeffree Star. But anyways, so hi guys, this is obviously Our Killer Podcast. If you haven't listened to our earlier episodes, you should like totally do that because they're really interesting. And if this is your first episode, I would probably suggest going back in listening to the other ones because
after this one,
we've got some cool episodes. Yeah, obviously so after this one.
This week, I'm going to be covering a kind of a big one, Jeffree Dahmer, and a little bit into more detail of his killings and his story and his childhood. So,
yeah, and then I am doing someone who's pretty interesting, who's also getting who may be getting a new Netflix series, like another like serial killer Netflix thing. Who is Charles Sobhraj? I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm bad. But basically, he's also known as the Bikini Killer, the Splitting Killer, or the Serpent, which is super cool. And so,
he's so cool.
Yeah, he's super cool. Killing a bunch of people.
Yeah. So, I believe it's your turn to go first.
It is my turn to go first, but I actually have something super cool to share. There is another serial killer who got another movie made about him, and that is Ted Bundy. It's on Netflix. It's called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, and it stars.
It's been out for like over a year.
Well, yeah, I know, but like it's available on this thing now, so I haven't watched it, and so basically
on Netflix?
I didn't. Yeah. I didn't watch it, but basically,
it's been on Netflix like a really long time.
Well, I'm telling people who didn't get to see it if they should go and see it. It's extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile, and whatever. And so I was watching it before this, and it's actually really good. I'm liking it so far. I'm like a little over halfway done with it. But
I was actually talking to my friend about that recently. That movie, I watched it, so I heard about it coming out before it was ever released to anything, and I was like totally obsessed. I was like, oh my gosh, I really want to watch this. And then it wasn't even released till Netflix like a year after it came out, but I think it was released like a year ago now. So the minute it came on Netflix, I was watching it, and I didn't at first understand why that they put Zac Efron as the main character, but then I got it because during the time period that Ted Bundy was in trial, there were so many people like, no, he couldn't do it. Like, look at him. He's so nice. He's so pretty. Like, he's so smart. He's so intelligent. And that's the whole point they put Zac Efron. Because when we see Zac Efron, we're like, we want to make him a protagonist. And he's the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just such a weird play on your mind. It's like, you look at this guy and you're like, oh, I love him. But you're like, wait, this guy murdered several people.
Yeah.
So I kind of get why they put him there. And I kind of really like that casting.
Yeah, I agree. I was watching it. I'm not done with it yet. But it's just like you really kind of feel for Ted in a way. And that's impressive acting, especially if you know what that person did before you even go into the movie. So, yeah, there's just something interesting that I thought was cool. But yeah, so if you're like me and didn't get on the train when it was released last year, you can come on the train now and come watch it. It's super cool. But anyway, so into what I'm doing today. So basically, born April 6th in 1944, Charles Sobhraj is an infamous French thief and serial killer of people of Vietnamese and Indian origin. So he was also known as the Bikini Killer, the Splitting Killer, or the Serpent. So Charles was born to a Vietnamese mother and an Indian Sindhi father. And when he was young, his parents divorced and his father just up and left because he decided he didn't want to deal with it anymore. So after a few years of being kind of raised by a single mother, Charles was adopted by his mother's new boyfriend, who was a French army lieutenant stationed in French Indochina. But unfortunately for him, this love that the parents kind of gave him was very short-lived as he became neglected in favor of his mother and stepfather's newer children. So basically, as they kind of made a family for themselves, he was kind of booted off to the side. So he then proceeded to move back and forth between French Indochina and France. So he would move back to one country and then move back to the other one over a period of years. So in his teenage years, he kind of began to commit like really petty crimes and received his first jail sentence for burglary in 1963. So during his incarceration, he began to exhibit his first kind of signs of narcissistic or personality disorder, in which he manipulated the prison officials to get him things he wanted. So this, for an example of this, it mean like it kind of included him being allowed to keep books in his cell. That's not usually allowed. Like if a prisoner has books in their cell, it's because they either know how to manipulate the guards or they are hiding it because it's contraband. So during this time, he met a man named Félix Descogne. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's French. It's D-E-S-C-O-G-N-E. If anyone knows how to speak French or takes French and knows how to pronounce that, I'd be very grateful on learning how. But anyways, he was Félix was a wealthy young man and was a prison volunteer. So basically he would go to the prison and volunteer to help with the inmates and such like that. So when Charles was paroled, he moved in with Félix and began to enjoy the life of French high society. So basically he met Félix. They were like, haha, we're best bros. And then kind of moved in with him afterwards because his family didn't necessarily want him anymore. So
how many people did this guy kill? How many people did this guy
upwards
kill?
Of 12. Gotcha. Anywho, so basically with his newfound money from both Félix and burglaries and scams, he met a woman named Chantal Compagnon, I don't know, who he later proposed to and then married. So on the same day of this proposal, he was arrested for attempting to evade the police while driving a vehicle he had stolen. So he's not a super smart dude. But basically, after he was kind of released from jail, he married her. And in 1970, Charles and his wife left France in 1972 and moved to Asia to escape further arrest warrants because you know that Charles did not stop his crime spree because they never do. Anywho, so upon arrival in Mumbai, Charles was given a baby girl by his wife and he quickly resumed his lifestyle in this country, running a car theft and smuggling operation. So
that's great
parenting. Yeah, super great parenting. So in 1973, Charles was arrested and imprisoned after an unsuccessful armed robbery attempt, but was able to escape with his wife's help. But then he was recaptured. So essentially, what happened is he escaped, she faked sick or whatever, and was like, oh, haha, I couldn't do anything. I'm a woman. And helped him, like, get out, but he was captured again. So, after another kind of stint in the robbery, during this time, he was kind of helped by his wife. So, he was robbing people, and his wife was helping him. So that, like, during this time, he moved from India to Kabul to Iran. And by the time they arrived in Iran, he was like, alrighty, let's keep going. And his wife was like, no, I'm leaving you and I'm taking our daughter with me. So she left him and returned back to France. And so after his wife left him, Charles spent the next 2 years on the run from authorities. And he went through several different countries in Eastern Europe and throughout the Middle East. And during his time in the Middle East, he was joined by his younger half-brother. So the one from that French lieutenant, whose name was Andre. So they immediately are super buddy-buddy. They become partners in crime. And they were quickly arrested in Athens after several unsuccessful criminal activities in Turkey and Greece. So,
criminal activity.
Mm-hmm. They just did a bunch of different things, like robbing and stealing and armed robbery. So just a bunch of not good things. So this is when they decide that they're going to do an identity switch thing. So basically, Charles is like, haha, that's Charles. And Andre is like, no, it's not. But basically, Charles escaped because of this identity switch. And his half-brother was left behind instead. So Andre was left to the Turkish and Greek authorities and served an 18-year sentence. So now we are going to go on to the murders that Charles committed. So into the grisly. So Charles committed several murders while doing other crimes. So in Thailand, Charles met a woman named Marie-Andrée Leclerc, who was a tourist from Canada. She quickly became his most devoted follower, ignoring his crimes with other women. So Charles was almost like a cult leader in this respect, as he gathered followers by gaining their loyalty through scams, asking people to do things in difficult situations or helping them through difficult situations. But usually he caused the difficult situations. So an example of this would be him helping a former French policeman recover a missing passport that he had stolen to begin with. And then another example would be Charles providing shelter to a Frenchman who appeared to be suffering from dysentery, which I told you what it was last week, so now you know. But in fact, Charles had actually been poisoning him. So he was like, oh, I'll help you get better from dysentery because no one else wants to be around you. Everything's going to be okay. When he, in fact, was the one who was poisoning him.
Yeah.
So, basically, his last follower was an Indian man named Ajay Chowdhury. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's Chowdhury. Again, if you know how to pronounce that, let me know. So, Ajay later became his second in command in all affairs. So, Charles and Ajay committed their first murder in 1975. So, at this point, Charles had been in this place for like 2 years by himself. So the first victim was a woman from Seattle named Teresa Knowlton. So she was found drowned in a tidal pool in the Gulf of Thailand wearing a flowered patterned bikini. Her death was originally deemed an accident and was only found out to be a murder several months after it was reported. So everyone thought she just accidentally was drowned. Like, she accidentally drowned.
Just yeah.
Swimming. So their next victim was a young man named Vitali Hakim, who was a young nomadic Sephardic Jew. And now I know what you're wondering, what the heck is a Sephardic Jew? Because I didn't know. And basically, they are they're also known as, like, kind of, it's Sephardim or Hispanic Jews, and they are a Jewish ethnic division originating from traditionally established communities in the Iberian Peninsula. So there's a lot of them in Israel and other places over there. But basically, it's just an ethnic division in the Jewish community. which I didn't know. And now you all do too. Anyhow. So his body was found burnt on the side of the road beside the Pattaya resort where Charles and his cultist gang were staying. So they're just kind of leaving bodies in their wake. So the next two victims were 29-year-old Hank Batanja and fiance Cornelia Hemker, who is 25. So these were two Dutch students who were invited to Thailand by Charles after meeting him in Hong Kong. So, but after a close call of discovery by the authorities or possibly other people, their bodies were found strangled and burned on December 16th, 1975. So the threat that Charles decided that he was going to kill these people over because he was originally just going to poison them and nurture them to be in his gang with him. But he decided he was just going to get rid of them because the previous victim's girlfriend, Sharminer, I don't know how to pronounce her name either. I'm sorry, guys. I'm not good with French names. So it was Charminer Carew. She came in looking for her boyfriend and wondering why he didn't come home and like why he what happened. And so she came and to investigate her boyfriend's death, and she was also found dead wearing a similar style swimsuit to an earlier victim of Charles. So basically, she came in looking for her boyfriend. He got scared, killed the couple, and then killed her. Wow. Mm-hmm. So this connection, this like similar swimsuit is why he's named the Bikini Killer. But a lot of his victims weren't in bikinis. They were simply just tourists. He preyed a lot on tourists who were kind of lost or unsure of their way around. So if you're ever in another country, don't look like you don't know where you're going. So basically, upon their arrival back in Thailand, because these people, on December 18th, forget I said anything, on December 18th, the pair traveled, so basically Charles and his buddy, Ajay, they traveled to Nepal with passports of a few people that he had murdered. And on December 21st and 22nd, which this is a beautiful Christmas present, sarcasm heavily implied, the pair murdered Laurent Carrier, who was 26, and Connie Bronsick, who was 29. So upon their arrival back in Thailand, there we go, the pair's French companions, so basically all three of the people that they had kind of like gotten before, kind of figured out that they were killing people. They had absolutely no clue. So no one besides Ajay knew that they were killing people except for Marie. So Marie's still in this thing, but she's kind of just like, oh, he's doing it for the good of the group. But the Frenchmen, all three of them were like, oh, heck no. So they fled back to France and immediately alerted the authorities. They were like, I don't care about the consequences. You're hurting people. So basically, his next destination after being ratted out by his former followers was either Varanasi or Calcutta. They aren't really sure which, like, where it was. But basically, he murdered an Israeli scholar whose name was Avani Jacob simply to take his passport. And that is why they don't necessarily know which place he was in, because he took someone else's passport. But they do know that he killed that person. So basically, as a case was being mounted against Charles, he fled to Malaysia with his partner. And so basically, this is where things kind of go bad for Ajay. So Ajay Chowdhury, whatever, I don't know how to pronounce his name, was sent to kind of steal for Charles. He was sent to go get him some jewels and then come back. And then on his way back to deliver the gems to him, this was the last time that Ajay was ever seen. His remains, or him, has never been found. There has been one isolated report saying that they found him in West Germany, but then that was not valid. Like, they saw him alive, but that it wasn't him. And so they have absolutely no clue what happened to him. So now, without a partner other than his loyal Marie, he kind of flees back to Asia. So Charles begins to kind of make a new family for himself in Asia. And so he finds two Western women who were kind of lost and unsure of themselves, named Barbara Smith and Mary Ellen Ether, or Aether. I don't know. It's E-A-T-H-E-R. It's a very interesting last name. So after this, after he kind of makes this new family, his next victim was another Frenchman named Jean-Luc Solomon. And he, during a poisoning, during a robbery, left him dead. So basically, he was being robbed by Charles and his gang. They poisoned him to sedate him. And then it was too much poisoning, so he killed him. Like, by accident. Ooh. Or so he says. In July 1976, Charles and his gang of women moved to New Delhi, where he tricked a tourist group of French graduates into accepting all four of them as a tour guide, which is really weird. So he gave them all poison pills, but they were more powerful than Charles had intended. So three of the students realized that he was what he was doing and overpowered him and contacted the police. This event specifically led to his capture. So during investigation and interrogation, the two women, not Marie, Smith and Aether, quickly confessed. And Charles was charged with the murder of Solomon, and all of them were sent to the Tahar prison in New Delhi. So, the two women, Smith and Aether, attempted suicide in prison 2 years before their trial because they didn't want to be committed. Like, they didn't want to be convicted of it. Poisoning or otherwise. And so Charles entered prison with gems concealed on his person and bribed his new captors into letting him live comfortably in jail, as he had done previously. So he made his trial kind of into a show or a spectacle where he hired and fired lawyers when he wanted to, brought up his younger brother, who he had left to be convicted by himself, as a witness, and going on a hunger strike. And then throughout all of this, he was then sentenced to 12 years in prison. 12 years.
12.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So Marie-André Leclerc was found guilty of drugging the students, but was later paroled and returned to her home country, which is Canada. So while in Canada, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and claimed her innocence while still being loyal to Charles when she died in her home on April 1984. So she lived a decent life. She lived from like 1944 to 1984. So, but yeah, so here's the kicker though. So at the end of his 12-year sentence, on the 17th of February, 1997, a now 52-year-old Charles was released with most warrants, evidence, and witnesses against him being lost or unable to be used. So, Basically, because he had done multiple crimes in different countries, and he was convicted and he served his time, by the end of his time, all of the warrants or evidence or anything had reached their limit. He could not be tried by the extent of the law.
Wow, that's an actual...
Even though they wanted to, but it was too late. So he couldn't be extradited to anywhere. So basically, without a country to extradite him to, he was forced to be released. So Charles retired to suburban Paris, where he hired a publicity agent. Because he was now a celebrity. He was signing autographs and getting money from these autographs, too. And so, but on the 17th of September in 2003, Charles was seen in the streets of Nepal, which was a country that, you know, he'd previously murdered people in, and then it was reported to the Nepalese authorities, who arrested him 2 days later. So, on the 20th of August, 2004, he was sentenced to life in prison for the murders of two former victims. So, I'm not completely sure why they were like able to convict him on two 1975 murders, but they were able to. I don't think
murders typically have
I think what happened is that they weren't sure that it was murder until that point. But I don't know.
Yeah.
But
what I'm saying is, like, I don't think murder has a statute of limitations.
Yeah.
You can be tried for a murder at any point after the murder. Yeah.
But anywho, so on the 20th of August, 2004, he was sentenced to life in prison. So in the last few years, Charles was convicted of several murders in other countries because of his former victims due to new evidence. And basically it extended his sentence if he did get parole. So if he went to any other country, if he got paroled, in Nepal, he would have to stay there because he would immediately get extradited to another country, which is basically in any other country where he was convicted, his sentence was as low as 90 years and as high as life in prison. So there's, even if he does get out, there's no chance that he's not going to be in prison. So, but as of 2018, Charles was diagnosed as being in critical condition and has had several open heart surgeries and is scheduled for several more. So, Charles is still kicking at, I believe, 82 years old. And so is the Serpent of Asia. He is a terrible person. And I got all of my information off of Wikipedia, so thank you, Wikipedia. But it just had the best information out of all of the sites that I was looking at to do my notes and research. And just, he's just not a good person. He's very manipulative.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think it's time for a quick break. Go get some water, stretch your legs, and we'll come back and talk about Jeffrey.
Mm-hmm. Bye. We are back. And I do believe it is now Tay's turn to...
It is, in fact.
Tell us a tale of awfulness while I drink apple cider.
Yeah. Hold your horses. I am currently dealing with something that I do not anticipate coming up.
You are good. But, so, yeah, for those of you who don't know, Dahmer, you're in for a bit of a treat, and I say this completely sarcastically.
Honestly, yeah. So, basically, Jeffrey Dahmer, there's so much about him.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on. Y'all are about to hear a conversation with my boyfriend, because he's like, I have to call you, and I'm like, what? So this is going to be a fun little bit that I might or might not edit out. Mog, I am literally in the middle of recording a podcast. Yeah, so when I say I can't call, it's because I can't call. Goodbye.
Yeah, we definitely need to edit that one out.
I have no idea. Anyways. So, Jeffrey Dahmer, let's just get right into it. His childhood... Right off the bat, he was kind of an odd person. He was very independent. So he enjoyed things like, I don't know, dead animals. And he would go as far as to take dead animals or roadkill that he might have seen off the street or something. And he would take them to like this shed they had in his house. And he would like examine them, dissect them, and even go as far as to put them into like glass jars and keep them there. Right. So... Yeah. So this all, according to Jeffrey Dahmer's dad, his name is Lionel, this all came from when Jeffrey was seeing animal bones under their new house. So they moved into this new house and they went into the shed to like clean everything off, and they, you know, found dead animal bones. And it thrilled Jeffrey, like the sound of the bones make. So this is kind of just context to like how Jeffrey Dahmer was at a get-go. Like, I don't know. So then in October of 1966, the family moved to Ohio. And as a teen, Jeffrey was an outcast and he started to develop drinking habits due to knowing and feeling like he was an outcast. He would start bringing hard liquors to school and beer and just things like that. And when his friends would ask him, like, hey, like, why are you drinking? Like, why are you doing that? He would just call alcohol and refer to it as his medicine.
Interesting. That's not healthy. Yes.
And his grades weren't great, considering all the drinking he was doing during school. But he was a part of the tennis team, really enjoyed that, and was part of band as well, and also really enjoyed that. And he very quickly...
So he had other less deadly hobbies.
Yeah. But we're not even up to the deadly hobbies yet. So he was kind of very quickly referred to as a class clown. That was kind of the impression he gave people. And he started doing random things for attention purposes. Mm-hmm. And we believe that a lot of the attention that he wanted to receive was due to neglect in his household. He had parents that were kind of just always constantly fighting, constantly yelling, and just doing things like that. And he felt really neglected. And so people believe that the reason he would purposely pull pranks, would purposely do just absolutely crazy and obscure things was because it was an attention cry. He enjoyed giving him attention. And he actually, it became like a catchphrase in the school of like doing a Dahmer. Because they would like tell Jeffrey, do a Dahmer, do a Dahmer. And he would do some sort of crazy, obscure thing. He would yell, he would make attention. Like he would just, that was just how it was. And that's also obviously why he was referred to as a class clown. So...
Also, real quick, I kind of want to clarify my comment of, oh, poor baby. I'm not making fun of people who get abused and are crying out for attention or whatever, for emotional instability. I'm making fun of Jeffrey Dahmer in particular. I just wanted to clarify so people weren't like, what the heck? Anyways, continue.
So in 1977, his parents got divorced, and this was not a surprise, but... For any child, a divorce is going to be a hard thing to deal with at any age, regardless of whatever. And his grades started going down quite a bit, and his alcohol intake went up. He started drinking a lot more, and because he just, and this was all just from feeling neglected in so many different ways. So there was a kind of a point when he was in high school and all of his friends were like taking out girls to dates and hooking up with girls and like doing all these things. And he very quickly felt different from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the point where he realized that he was not fantasizing about girls the way his friends were fantasizing about girls. Rather, he was fantasizing about guys the way his friends fantasized about girls. And that he quickly realized that he liked guys the way all of his friends liked girls. Mm-hmm. This was something that during this time period was something that you were ashamed of. Like, it was not an accepted thing.
Yeah.
So he really tried to suppress all of these feelings. And yeah. So in June of 1978, Jeffrey essentially had the house to himself. His mom, after the divorce, like moved away. And his dad started staying at a motel. And so Jeffrey was just kind of at the house by himself.
Interesting. So he was just kind of living there.
Yeah. And we're just going to jump right into the first murder.
Okay.
When Jeffrey, he was out of high school at this point, and he was driving one night, and he saw a hitchhiker on the side. And
don't hitchhike, guys.
Seriously. He decided to pick up the hitchhiker. This hitchhiker's name was Stephen Hickel, I think. Hickel? Stephen Hicks.
Hicks.
And he's 19 years old. So Jeffrey convinced Hicks to go with him to his house, and they were just going to have fun. And they get to Jeffrey's house, and they're, like, drinking, and they're listening to music and whatever. Stephen was kind of like, okay, like, I think it's time for me to, like, go. Like, I want to go back to where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was there, guys, I'm not going to lie, this story does get to be a sexual thing, because this is all deriving from sexual fetishes. So, if that is a trigger for you, you might want to go ahead and sign off.
Yeah.
But we're just going to be totally real, because there's just really no way to get around it for Jeffrey Dahmer, considering it's where everything drives from. Jeffrey wanted to have sex with Hicks. And
well, after years of repressing it, he probably was like, this is my chance.
Yeah. So when Hicks was like, hey, you know, man, I think I really want to go, like, where I was trying to get to. Can you take me there? Jeffrey took a 20-pound barbell
and hit
Stephen on the back of the head twice.
Oh, my goodness.
When Stephen fell unconscious, Jeffrey took the barbell and strangled him and then committed necrophilia.
That is not how you ask a guy out, okay? You don't.
He then dismembered Stephen Hicks' body and buried him in the backyard. Later, when he realized he probably needed to find a better way to dispose of the body for sake of not getting caught, this is also about to be very, very graphic. I am just quite literally repeating facts. So again, if you are triggered by any of this, feel free to sign off. No feelings hurt.
Or skip ahead. But honestly, it doesn't get any better.
That's not going to work either. So he later went back to the body and he took the flesh off of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And
so he skinned him, kind of.
Poured acid on it.
Oh, boy.
And then took that sludge and washed it down the toilet. He took his bones and a sledgehammer.
Thank goodness.
And just smashed up the bones and then spread them through the woods in the back of the house.
Well done.
So there was a point when Jeffrey's dad came back and he kind of saw that Jeffrey was kind of like drinking and not doing anything. So he decided to start taking Jeffrey to AA meetings, and Jeffrey even ended up enrolling in Ohio State University, but dropped out after 3 months due to having a GPA of 0.3.
Oh my goodness. How do you have a 0.3 GPA?
He joined the Army after this to try to do something like with his life. Oh, the GPA was from excessive alcohol abuse.
Oh, yeah, because he wasn't doing anything or going to classes?
He was drinking.
He was drinking instead?
Constantly.
Got it.
Well, not necessarily instead, but maybe during.
Mm.
He was just constantly abusing alcohol. So he joined the Army and was stayed in there for 2 years, but was discharged due to excessive alcohol abuse. So at this point, after the Army, he just decided to move to Miami. Like, it was like, okay, whatever.
You know what? They'll accept my alcoholism.
Yeah. Well, it's because he was from Ohio, so nobody really knows why he just was, like, up into Miami, but...
Well, it's because it's a party town, I say, as a person who kind of, you know, used to live there. It's a party town. It's bars, it's drinking, it's up all night, it's the high life.
Jeffrey wasn't really a partier, he was just a drinker.
Well, yeah, but there's a lot of bars there that you could go to without being shamed for going.
Well, anyways, he ended up staying in a hotel or a motel and working in a sandwich shop, but he could not really afford that. Like, he could not really make ends meet. So his dad offered him a plane ticket back to Ohio and to move there. And Jeffrey just took the opportunity and he moved back to Ohio into a house with his grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
So things started getting better when he was living with her. He was doing chores around the house. He even went as far as to go to church, you know, get a job, things like that.
He was trying.
But his sexual feelings started to come up again. And this is when he starts fantasizing about men again. And, like, it comes back up because it was who he was. And that just is. So he started kind of experimenting with men at bars and bathhouses. And he would go there, but with the men he would meet, he would end up, like, spiking their drinks.
That's not how you ask a guy out.
And he would drug them. He essentially used a date rape drug on them.
Yeah.
Would drug them, rape them, leave, and when they woke back up, they didn't even know what happened. He was gone. And that was basically what everybody believes to be Jeffrey Dahmer's original MO, was just a date rape drug and assaulting men. So we're going to actually move on to Jeffrey Dahmer's second victim, Stephen Twomey, I think his name was. And they met at a 219 bar in November of 1987. And Jeffrey was known to be very charming at these bars.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was just a charmer. He really had a way to, like, bring people in. And Stephen went to his hotel room with him, you know. And Jeffrey says the last thing he remembers is waking up with bruised fists and Stephen's body on the floor.
Oh, boy.
This was the only murder he ever admitted to just completely, like, not remembering. Like, it's going to become a common trend in the next few ones that we go over that he tends to black out or drink a lot, so he doesn't remember it very well. But this is the only one he completely cannot remember what happened or why.
Interesting. So,
when this happened, Dahmer saw, you know, Stephen on the floor of the motel. He was like, oh, gosh. And then he went to a store, found the biggest suitcase he could find, and put Stephen in the suitcase and then took it back to his grandmother's house. And put the suitcase with Stephen's body in the basement. He then continued to dismember the body and attempted to preserve... He decapitated the head and attempted to preserve the head, but it was unsuccessful for obvious reasons, because things decompose.
Yeah.
So he disposed Jeffrey... Wait, so he disposed the body. Jeffrey liked keeping parts of bodies as trophies, kind of like... Almost like also like memorabilia.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like to remember that person that he killed, but not as a person.
Yeah. So the third victim is James Dater. And Jeffrey met, this was a 14-year-old boy, and he met him outside baby. Of a bar waiting. Ness isn't even the youngest one.
I know.
Waiting for a bus. And Jeffrey offered for him to spend the night. Wait. Huh. Jeffrey meets James outside of a bar and when he's waiting for a bus, and he offered $50 for James to spend the night with Jeffrey. And we don't really know what happened. We know that there was some kind of physical interaction. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it was not actually like sex, but there was some kind of physical interaction between the two. And then Jeffrey drugged and strangled him. And then he kept the body in the basement for 2 weeks, committed necrophilia, and disposed the body after 2 weeks. This was the body that Jeffrey kept around the longest.
I wonder why.
I think because he... Well, we'll actually have the answer to that, but we'll have to get to it later. But he committed necrophilia multiple times over the course of 2 weeks with his body. So, he would drink a lot before the murders and essentially black out for periods of time. And this is actually an interesting point because Jeffrey Dahmer was not a sociopath. And here's the reason. When looking up all of these things, it comes up that during his trial, he obviously went through several psych evaluations and none of them deemed him to be a sociopath. And this is because sociopaths do not know the difference between, they do not have like a moral compass.
Uh-huh.
They do not get right and wrong. And not to say like they don't know society's standards of right and wrong, but they do not feel guilt of right and wrong.
Yeah.
It was due to like Jeffrey Dahmer's excessive drinking that... And, like, wanting to drink and blackout right before every murder, that we know that he knew the difference between right and wrong.
So he was why he was blacking out so that he wouldn't have to deal with the consequences.
He wouldn't, not necessarily consequences, but it was a guilt thing.
Yeah, he wouldn't have to feel guilty. He would just be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. So he used alcohol as an escape. So that's how we know that he was not an actual sociopath. Now, I'm actually going to go to notes on my iPad, which I'm recording on. So can y'all still hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just making sure, because I left the screen.
You are good.
We're going to get back into... some notes over here. So, again, he was also not considered insane either, which is very hard for a lot of people to, like believe. But he was not considered insane. He was not considered a sociopath. He was a psychopath, but not a sociopath.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's easier for people to believe that something else caused it, that something made them like that, like a mental disorder or something along those lines, that or that they didn't just do it, you know?
Yeah.
It's easier to blame something else than just kind of accept that some people are just awful.
So on to the next victim. It was Richard Gerardo at a bar. He met him there. And Jeffrey offered him money for the night and money, like, to come with him for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed, and he was also drugged and strangled. A bit later, he dismembered the body and put it in trash cans for the garbage collectors to get the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Trash cans and, like, trash bags.
Got it.
So, his grandmother asked him to move out due to drinking and coming late and, like, being loud at night. Because, like, this was kind of, like, Jeffrey started drinking more. He was coming in really late. When he'd come in, he'd be really loud. And there, she kind of noticed, like, a weird smell coming from the basement. And when she asked him about it, he didn't have an answer that he could, like, give her. So she just asked him to move out. Like, it was becoming more trouble than it was worth. And
yeah.
So he ended up moving to an apartment on the west side of Milwaukee. And he met a 13-year-old boy on the sidewalk near where he lived. He lured him to the apartment, and Jeffrey tried to fondle the boy. And the boy got scared and ran away, and the police report was filed. And Jeffrey was charged with second-degree assault. Now, between this assault and his trial, he meets Anthony Sears. He met at a bar, took to his apartment, drugged, and strangled. You're gonna hear this often. Jeffrey's MO was spot on every time. Drugged, strangled.
Which is really interesting, because a lot of, like, not all kind of serial killers follow this pattern. Not all serial killers are like, this is my MO. This is what I'm going to do every single time. Well, some serial killers do differentiate a lot. Like, between...
He wasn't, like, thinking, like, this is my MO. It's just the way that he preferred
to do it. No, I know.
I think he could have been a little OCD, but I'm not really sure.
That's what makes it so interesting, is that it wasn't, like, purposeful or anything. It was just his subconscious, this is what I like to do. And it just happened to be the exact same thing over and over and over again, which is increasingly interesting when it comes to serial killers, because not a lot of serial killers are that specific. But anyways,
so the sentencing has started for the second degree sexual assault, which also the fact that they called a second degree sexual assault really confuses me, because a sexual assault is a sexual assault means penetration. And I'm not, this isn't an opinion thing. I literally know this. It's the law. Sexual assault means penetration. And if it was fondling and nothing else, then it can't be sexual assault. But I don't know. I didn't look into that very much. So, at the end of his trial, his dad asked the judge to send him to a rehabilitation center for just drinking and everything, but that was declined, and then Jeffrey was released after only spending 10 months in prison. 10 months.
Oh my goodness.
It was a sexual assault charge.
I know, but still, that's just aggravating.
Yeah. So then he moved to an apartment again that was closer to bars. And after prison, he went on a spree and got more picky with his victims. Before this point, he didn't really care what his victims looked like. He just kind of went after anybody that he felt he had the means to get. And after this point, he kind of started only going after African-American men. And 3 weeks later, 3 weeks after he got released, he started a killing spree. And in 1 year, he killed 13 men.
Oh, babies. I didn't know that he went after specifically African-American men after his release. That's new information to me.
He geared towards them. And
interesting.
We're going to talk about one of these 13 men that really was just absolutely infuriating to read about. It's ridiculous and the biggest mistake, I think.
It's all infuriating, but I'm assuming this one is specifically...
Well, no, like, I try to, so when I do these cases, I try to start pretty, like, not biased. Mm-hmm. It's just really hard to not be, like, upset with this specific one. And mm-hmm. I'll explain it in a minute. This one's specifically enraging. Mm-hmm. In comparison to all the other ones.
Yeah.
So, one of the 13 victims that he killed in that 1 year was a 14-year-old boy, and his name was Connor Ack. When he was in Jeffrey's apartment, so essentially Jeffrey did his thing. He lured him to the apartment, drugged him, and then while he was drugged, Jeffrey went to the liquor store. But while Connor was sleeping. Mm-hmm. And when he was gone, Connor woke up and ran out of the apartment, essentially naked, yelling for help, and because he realized, like, what was happening.
Yeah.
Jeffrey's neighbor called 911. Police came, and Jeffrey showed up about the same time as the police and convinced the police that Connor Ack was his boyfriend and even invited the police into the apartment, and the police believed him and left Jeffrey, and Jeffrey killed Connor that night.
No. He was so close to being okay.
Yeah. He was just like, oh, this is my boyfriend. He's had a lot to drink. Like, I'm very sorry. So the bodies of Jeffrey's victims kind of started to pile up in his apartment, and he needed to find a way to be able to dispose of them. So he purchased a 57-gallon tank and put the bodies in there with acid.
Yeah.
And every one of his victims was dismembered. And this is where it gets kind of graphic again. In this giant tank drum, 57-gallon thing, he only put the torsos in there.
Mm. Only the torsos?
Yes. He would cook the skin of some of his victims on the stove.
Mm.
Neighbors started to notice a smell and noticed that he kind of, like, never came home with groceries, which is kind of questionable because it was like...
It is questionable. It's like, well, then what are you eating? Never
have groceries. Like, what is he eating? And uh-huh. then that with the smell, it was very confusing. And Jeffrey Dahmer was a cannibal and a necrophiliac.
Uh-huh.
He had major abandonment issues. Even though he had killed these victims, he didn't want them to leave. So when preserving their bodies didn't work, he kind of moved on to finding a different way to have them never leave him, and that turned into an eating obsession.
Yeah, because that way they would never leave him because they were a part of him. You are what you eat.
Yeah. So this all started with him trying to preserve the bodies, like I said, and that didn't last. Cannibalism is kind of where he turned to. So then we're going to go on to the last part of this whole thing, which is when Jeffrey met Tracy. Tracy was a man that he met at a bar, and he convinced him to come back to his apartment. The minute Tracy got into the apartment, he noticed that there was just something not right about the apartment.
Good job, Tracy.
And knew that he just needed to leave, like, had a gut feeling. So he ended up escaping from the apartment. And while he was running down the street, he noticed a cop car. And he approached the cop car and told him that he felt like something was just wrong and that there was just something not right. So the police, you know, the cop called for some backup, had the police go to Jeffrey's apartment. And when they walked in, they had never seen a, like, scene so horrific. There were 80 things that they found in his apartment were 83 Polaroid photos of the body parts. In the fridge, there were 4 decapitated heads. They also found pots and pans full of body parts of victims, as well as the torsos in the drum tank. Jeffrey was obviously immediately taken in and blamed every single thing that he did on his alcohol and said if he wasn't so drunk, maybe he would have never been caught. Jeffrey Dahmer murdered 17 men total. The police spent 6 weeks getting confession, and when he ended up confessing, it was 150 pages long.
150 pages long? Did he, like, dictate everything he did?
Well, it's a confession. He has to confess to every crime that he'd committed.
Oh, boy.
The police went back to Jeffrey's childhood home, and that's where they found the remains of the first victim, Stephen Hicks. The judge called Jeffrey the devil and that he was just pure evil. And his dad, Lionel Dahmer, sat through the entire trial in disbelief that this could be his child. The jury found Dahmer to be legally sane and was going to serve 930 years in prison. While in prison, he decided to turn his life around and got baptized. His father said that he even noticed Jeffrey humanizing again. Now, this does not say that he's a good person. It's just facts of what has been said about this case.
Mm-hmm.
During his trial, Jeffrey spoke and said that he was very sorry and that he wished he could take everything back and that he had never done it to the families of the victims.
Right.
On November 29th, 1994. Well, okay. I believe Jeffrey Dahmer in this statement because he is not a sociopath. He feels guilt. He feels remorse. He has emotion. Sociopaths don't have emotion.
Sociopaths don't necessarily have the same emotions as us either. So,
wait, what?
It could be psychopaths don't necessarily have the same like emotional capacity as us either.
Well, no, but the whole reason that they deemed him to not be a sociopath is because sociopaths don't feel emotion, don't know right from wrong. Jeffrey Dahmer does feel guilt, feels emotion, and things like that. That's why he had such a heavily drinking issue. Now, I'm not in any way defending him and saying that he, you know, deserves mercy because he doesn't. But I do believe that he felt a level of guilt for his crimes, and that the apology was probably at least partially authentic.
Yeah.
So,
but continue.
On November 29th, 1994, he was in the prison gym and a man came up to him and stabbed him. And that is the day that Jeffrey died.
That's the end of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yep. But, that is kind of just a briefing. There's so much more that goes into his story. Not even his story. I don't like giving it that kind of like title, his case, because there's just so many things that man did wrong.
The only thing that is with me is that while sociopaths have like a complete inability to like really feel human emotion the same way that we feel human emotion, psychopaths have impaired capacities. So it's not that they can't feel anything, it's that they don't feel it the same way as we do, which is why I don't believe that he truly felt guilt in the same way that we would assume he felt guilt. Not to say that he didn't, I just
Well, the reason I'm disagreeing with that is just because when reading up on this case and hearing how he did things, the entire reason that they didn't deem him to be a sociopath is the fact that he did feel guilt, and the fact that the way he would feel guilt was suppressing any all the emotions that he had with alcohol. So that he could black out when he did these things. Because he had these urges that he couldn't control. Now, again, not an excuse for him. He's a very much evil, very much the devil spawn. But I do believe that he felt levels of guilt for the crimes that he committed. And that is why, I believe that is why he apologized. Because he didn't have to.
Yeah, he didn't have
to. There was really no reason for him to.
Fair.
I'm not saying he felt every emotion. I'm saying he felt guilt.
No, I know.
And it matches up with his whole MO, too, on the, like, feeling guilt, the way that he committed his crimes. It makes sense. Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't think he feels things the exact same way that you and I do, but I think that his apology wasn't totally not true, or he wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think Bundy ever apologized to the families of the victims.
No, he didn't. He maintained his innocence.
Yeah, but Dahmer and Bundy are completely different types of serial killers.
Yeah, he insisted that he was innocent.
He was his own lawyer.
Huh?
He was his own lawyer.
I know. He insisted that he was, you know, not guilty on all charges when he was evidently guilty on all charges.
Yeah, and the thing about Bundy is he's such an interesting mind to me. God, in case anybody doesn't know, I literally am going to college to study criminal psychology. So
that's the new podcast, The Thing About Bundy.
Yeah. Well, literally next week I'm going to be covering Ted Bundy's case. I couldn't decide between Bundy or Dahmer this week, so I went Dahmer because I wanted to wait to give myself more time to prep for Bundy, because Bundy
is a whole different beast.
he's something I know way more about than I actually know about Dahmer. So with Bundy, I kind of think that in like some way he didn't believe that he did what he did. And my reason for that is the way he presented himself. He literally admitted to no one until he was on his deathbed. And and even when he was saying that, he was saying, oh, I'm just saying it to extend my time. Like, what? What? But he didn't even admit to his love of his life that he says. I forgot her name. He didn't even admit to her that he was guilty. Like,
He maintained that he was innocent because he believed that he hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, I think he had so many different mental issues, and I think that one of them could have been a way for him to differentiate his killing from like his life. I think he truly lived two lives and like two separate personalities.
Yeah, because he was a completely different person.
Yeah, so
between the two.
But that's putting us at over an hour, so I'm gonna go ahead and end this. So
but so basically I hope you have a great week this week, guys. Enjoy Christmas shopping, or enjoy making Christmas presents, whatever you do.
If you want to hear more about Christmas stuff, you can go to our other podcast.
That episode is up and published, where we talk about kind of Christmas plans and Christmas kind of traditions and things that we do, and also like our opinions on gift giving and what's kind of important about gift giving. And so just like stay safe and like don't die. We'll see you next week.